Thank you very much for that warm welcome, and thanks for the kind introduction, Mike, and it's great to be with you all here at the Fuel Ethanol Workshop. This is a great gathering of entrepreneurs and innovators and leaders of America, and I'm really honored to be with you. And Mike, I want to congratulate you and BBI on your 25 years of leadership and putting this organization together. I'm pretty active in all of these alternative energy things. I've been to the solar conferences, I've been to the wind conferences, and I've been working here in alternative fuels for the last about a year or so, and it's the same spirit of entrepreneurship, determination, resolve, technology, forward thinking that unites all of these sectors. We're all determined to make a difference in America's future. And I know that, you know, for you all here, this is about business today. I mean, and it should be. You're here to work business, and you've got a great business. You've created in this ethanol area a complete new business for America. You took a domestic crop, you figured out how to manipulate the crop and convert it to a fuel. You worked the process efficiency so that it became increasingly efficient. You worked the economics, you worked the marketing, you worked the politics of it so people could support it and use it. You've got it into automobiles, you've got it into the nation's fuel. You've built one heck of a business. Last time I checked, it was 500,000 people and $66 billion. America must sit up and take notice of our ethanol industry. Don't you agree? So at this conference, you're going to be looking at the new technologies. You're going to be rebuilding relationships. You're going to be looking for customers and clients. You're going to be getting new ideas. You're going to be looking at financing. You're going to be looking at everything about the market. This is where every year you come and you charge your batteries and out you go, and we're going to make this another great year in the ethanol industry. But look, let's be honest. This is not really just about business. This is really about national security, and that's why I'm here. I'm a national security guy. I grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas. I was 5 years old when the Korean War started, and there was a man who lived up the street, and he was called up to service, and I remember playing in the backyard and listening to the radio reports of fighter jets, MiGs and Sabres going at it in MiG Alley, and I remember thinking to myself, why would planes be in an alley? And I remember when the fellow came back from war, and it was 1951, and my mother told me, said, you can't talk to him. He was like 20 years old. He was a big boy who lived up the street. Said, you can't talk to him because he's shell-shocked. All he can talk about is they keep coming, they keep coming, they keep coming. I was there as a youngster when we talked about how the Americans had the H-bomb and the Soviets only had an A-bomb, and there were actually people talking about attacking the Soviet Union before they could get an H-bomb. President Eisenhower was smart enough not to do that. I was there when I was in the 6th or 7th grade when the Hungarian Revolution occurred, and the Soviet tanks came in and crushed freedom in Eastern Europe. In 1957, and many of you there's a few people here with as much gray hair as I've got, but that's when the first Sputnik was launched. Until that time, America was secure and isolated from the world, protected by our bomber fleets and our advanced technology, and suddenly there was this Earth satellite, and it showed that the Russians were ahead, and a shock went across America. I don't know if you've seen that movie, October Sky, but I was one of those little kids who was out there in the backyard trying to invent rockets to help America defend itself. And that's how I learned my chemistry, basically. The way you did it is somebody said, well, you know, it's just like gunpowder. Said, you can go to the drugstore and you can buy, you know, you go into the drugstore, you buy sulfur and a little bag of 1 pound of sulfur, and you get some potassium nitride, and you can buy that in the drugstore too. And then you take your backyard barbecue grill charcoal and you grind that up, and then you mix it up real carefully, and then you pack it, and that's the way you make this. And then somebody said, no, you don't want potassium nitride. Go in there and ask for potassium nitrate because it's got more oxygen in it, and it burns better. So then they said, no, that's better. That works, but it's better if you get potassium chlorate. And then you need potassium perchlorate because the oxygen bond is better. So there were a bunch of eighth graders, and we were all studying chemistry. And finally, none of it worked very well. We ended up taking apart shotgun shells and getting shotgun powder and packing them in. Some of our friends had access to machine shops, and we actually built rockets and launched them. But it was symptomatic of the time in America when people were really afraid for this country. We didn't know what was going to happen in our future. We knew there was an adversary out there that was committed to destroy us. A couple of years later, Nikita Khrushchev, the leader of the Soviet Union, went to that farm in Iowa and promised to destroy America. Some guessed, huh? And I was in high school when the Berlin crisis started in 1961. So it was a pretty natural thing for me to want to go to West Point. In those days, and everybody had a military obligation. And if you went to a land-grant college like the University of Arkansas or University of Colorado, you went to ROTC for 2 years. Everybody did. And most people had served in World War II. It was just sort of a natural thing. So I went to West Point. I'm a big believer in national security. And I graduated. I went to Vietnam. I came home on a stretcher. And a lot of people got tired of the military and said it wasn't worth it. I thought there was nothing better than standing up for your country and wearing a uniform and being proud of America. And that's why I stayed with it for another 30 years. And I believe that today. And I believe that in the ethanol business, this is the essence of national security for America in the 21st century. You know, when I went to Oxford in the late 60s, I did study philosophy, politics, and economics, and believe me, it does tie together. And Mike, see me afterwards and let me tell you about how it works, okay? But it does come together. But at that time, you know, America was a net oil exporting nation. We discovered oil here in America. We produced it here in America. The rest of the world tried to copy us. The Brits, the Dutch, they were all over the world trying to do what we had in our own backyard in Texas and Oklahoma and California and Pennsylvania and the Midwest. It was oil, and here in Colorado, and it was ours. But sometime in the late 60s, oil production in the United States began to decline, and consumption continued to grow. And we realized that we were in a situation where we were going to have to start buying oil abroad and bringing it into the United States and actually using it here. And about that time, someone was writing about monopolies, and a group of Arab countries got together and they said, you know, we could form a monopoly on oil. We could call it the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. And, you know, why should we let these Americans sell their oil and buy our oil cheap for $2 and $3 a barrel? Let's raise the price. And it took a couple of years. They got it together. There was a study done that kind of set the stage for this called the Club of Rome study in 1972. I was teaching economics at West Point. I remember when the study came out, and it was one of these doom and gloom studies, you know. About every 30 or 40 years, the neo-Malthusians get together. You know, the people that say the world's going to run out of food, the end is near, repent now, and so forth. And this was another one of these dressed-up neo-Malthusian things. We're going to run out of oil, we're going to run out of steel, we're going to run out of gold, we're going to run out of electricity. But it added to the temperament. And in 1973, then the oil embargo started in conjunction with some scarcity and then with the Yom Kippur War in Israel. And before we knew it, Americans weren't buying gasoline for 25 cents a gallon. We were buying it for $1.25 a gallon. And it was a huge shock to the United States of America. Well, I was one of the first people who went down to the Pentagon, and we looked at this, and we looked at the national security implications. I remember being down there in the summer of 1973. I wrote a paper for the Army Operations Directorate looking at what the impact would be of our dependence on foreign energy sources and where the oil was coming from in the Persian Gulf. And it was pretty obvious that if you have a vital resource that's coming from abroad, and you can't run your economy without it, then it becomes in your vital national security interest to protect the access to it. You don't have to own it. You don't have to put a bunch of soldiers on top of it. You don't have to have a military exploration and drilling company to get it out. But it is about national security. And I remember writing this paper, and I'm sitting in the office with a bunch of, all of us are Vietnam vets, a bunch of wise full colonels and lieutenant colonels in the office. They read what I'd written about. Possibly someday we might need to send troops to the Persian Gulf to secure our access to foreign energy sources. And then one of the colonels turns to me and he says, "Young captain," he says, "you write that paper like that, it's going to leak out of this Pentagon. It's going to get in the Washington Post." He says, "and that Senator Fulbright's going to have us all up there testifying, and we're going to get fired. You change that paper." Of course, being who I am, of course, I didn't change the paper. And I did brief it. And I briefed it to the generals, and they sort of nodded and said, "yeah, it might happen, it might happen." And look at it now, 35 years later. Is there any doubt that that $100-some-odd billion a year, the 4,000 lives that we've lost, the 80,000 injured coming out of that operation, the total cost of $2 trillion, is there any doubt what that's related to? You don't think it's about some abstract political philosophy dispute. This is about America's need for imported oil. It distorts our foreign policy. It makes friends of people who aren't our friends. It makes adversaries of people who really wouldn't be our adversaries. It creates interests where we really don't have any interests at all. The difference between the Middle East and Africa, very simple. Where is the oil? Not only does it distort our foreign policy, but it's the kind of interest that when you sprinkle that money out there, and if you look at who's selling us oil, a lot of these countries aren't necessarily our friends. Or if they are our friends, some of the people in them who get the money aren't necessarily our friends. I don't have any problem with Canada. I like Canada. But when you start going down the list and you start looking at the Middle East and you start looking at Venezuela and other things, you say, well, exactly, I mean, what is this relationship we're in with these countries where they're raising their fists and shaking at us and funding people who don't like us, and we're paying them billions of dollars a year for their oil? That's national security, ladies and gentlemen. And there's one more thing. One of the greatest curses for a developing country is to discover oil. If you look at the countries that are trying to develop and take care of their own people, whenever they discover oil, it distorts their development. Take the case of Nigeria. Got more oil than anybody else in Africa, 140 million people, rampant with corruption. I did a study when I was the commander in Europe of Nigerian corruption, and we easily identified more than $5 billion a year in the mid-90s that was flowing out of Nigeria. Most of it was going to real estate in France and Switzerland and banks. But it wasn't helping the people of Nigeria. And today, there's an ongoing insurgency in Nigeria as people are killing each other and disrupting oil caused by what? The corruptive effect of America's hunger for oil. So this is national security. And if that wasn't enough, there's the whole issue, which we're now beginning to understand, about climate change and global warming. It really is a national security issue. We had a group of colonels up at the U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, 3 years ago do a study of it. They said, "what is the real impact of climate change?" I said, "pretty profound. If it keeps up at the rate it's going, you'll see changes in rainfall pattern, you'll see glaciers melting, you'll see hundreds of millions of people displaced by rising sea levels. You'll see crops fail, you'll see new pests and diseases move north and south toward the polar regions, you'll see massive dislocation. Dislocation economically, dislocation socially, dislocation politically means conflict. And that conflict means national security. So from every aspect, what you're doing is about national security. I know you're here for business, and we want you to make a profit. But I don't think there's any industry in America in which the good sense of making a profit is any more closely related to the good work of national security than this industry of ethanol. This is America's domestic growth fuel, and we need it for our country's security. Look, ethanol addresses every one of the national security concerns that people are worried about. First of all, it's produced here. This is America's fuel, and you know it. Rather than spending a dollar on imported oil, we spend a dollar on ethanol. That money stays in the United States. It's not going to the Middle East, to Iraq or Saudi Arabia or some other country that may or may not share America's real interests. It's staying here in our own country. It gives us the flexibility to have the kind of foreign policy that we want, based on good judgment, good values, and what's in the long-term interest of America, rather than scrambling for short-term access to a resource like oil. It lets us lead in technology. It lets us work development abroad without having it disrupted by petrodollars flowing in and undercutting local good governance. And in terms of climate change, every gallon of ethanol saves about 50% or 60% right now in global greenhouse gas emissions compared to a gallon of gasoline. And that's right now. And every year, we're making this ethanol industry more and more efficient. One study showed that since 2001, the average ethanol producer has cut water consumption by 25%. He's cut energy consumption in the process by 21%. And he's improved the take of ethanol from a bushel of corn by 6%. Now, that's a pretty dynamic industry. There's not many industries in America that can claim that kind of year-in, year-out productivity improvement. So I think we're on a national security roll, and I think we have to understand it is a national security problem. So you would think that this industry would be a slam dunk, right? 500,000 people, $66 billion. It's based on America's greatest resource, which is the innovation and skill of our agricultural community. The greatest agricultural community in the world ever is right here, and we're basing our fuel industry on it. And in doing so, we're actually reducing global greenhouse gas emissions and strengthening America's national security and keeping money at home in a time when we need jobs and money. It's a slam dunk, right? But why isn't it? And this is to reinforce something you were saying up here earlier, Mike, because a couple of things. One thing, we're a pretty big industry, and I think you got to face the reality. When you're producing 10 billion gallons a year of ethanol, somebody's not selling 10 billion gallons a year of something else. And at the margin, that's real money. And so some people got their rice bowl upset. They see the future. They're seeing ethanol continue to grow. They're saying, God, how can an industry, how can it come from like a billion gallons a year to 6 billion to 8 billion to 10 billion just like that overnight? Where is it going to stop? And what's left for us? So you got a lot of defensiveness out there. And you've got some well-meaning people who, they kind of misunderstood some of the things that were happening. Now, I took a real hard look at this food versus fuel argument. It just doesn't hold water. And I want to reemphasize something Mike was saying up here. You all have to be, you're the frontline soldiers in this fight, and you've got to take that fight back in your local communities. There's so much productivity in America's agricultural community, and the farmer is so far down on the profit and cost chain in food production that study after study after study has shown that increases in ethanol have no or marginal impact on food pricing in America. And if you didn't believe it, look at what's happened in the last year. The price of corn went down. The price of food stayed high. It's not like they said, oh, by golly, now we can get food prices back to normal. Now corn's gone down to $4 a bushel. They don't do that. That's because corn and the price of that the farmer gets for the corn is a very small component of the price of food in America. Not only that, if you look at the productivity of American agriculture, and particularly in corn, We've kept the same acreage under production or less in this country since the 1930s. And we've doubled and more than doubled our corn production. We're up to over 150 bushels an acre, and we're growing at 2, 3% per year in productivity. We can produce all the corn-based ethanol America will ever want without ever affecting the amount of corn that's for sale in the supermarkets, or corn that's going to cattle, or corn that's being exported, or corn that's just standing by in the bin waiting for somebody to do something with it. There's plenty of corn out there, and we need to make sure the American people understand it. And it's not a matter of price. It's simply a matter of productivity. You got to pay the farmer enough to grow the corn, and he grows it. And that's about $4 a bushel. And at $4 a bushel, we're saving the government billions of dollars in farm support payments to corn growers. And at the same time, we're producing fuel and returning about half the value of that corn in grain back to the livestock and poultry industry as distiller's grain. So we've got to take on this argument of food versus fuel. We've really got to take it on. And there's another argument that's out there that people don't understand. They're talking about this indirect land use charge. I looked at these models. I'm pretty good at models. I've been doing it. That's what I did, you know, at Oxford studying economics over there, is looking at models. So I looked at the models. I went out and testified in front of the California Air Resources Board. I listened to what their scientists had to say out there. And this is a great theory, okay? Here's the theory. Hey, these guys want to use corn for ethanol. Well, if they took all this corn off the market and they didn't use it for food, like, well, wouldn't that impact the food supply? Well, yeah. Well, what would you do? Well, you'd have to, you know, grow more soy. Well, if you use more soy for food, well, then what about elsewhere in the world? Well, that means they'd have to grow more soy. Well, where would they get the soy? Well, in Brazil, they'd have to cut down the rainforest. Well, okay, then that settles it. You can't grow corn and use it for ethanol because the Brazilians might cut down their rainforest. Now, if you ever laid it out that simplistically, everybody laughs. Say, well, that's absurd. I mean, there's a million different factors that influence whether rainforests get cut down or not. And in fact, if you look at the record, while we've doubled ethanol production, in Brazil, they've cut deforestation of the Amazon in half. So you say, well, it doesn't add up, but it's worse than that. It's the whole logic of it that's wrong in the model. There's plenty of agricultural productivity in America to produce all the corn we ever need from the existing land. So the idea that somehow we're going to cause worldwide diversions of cropland because we're converting bushels of corn into ethanol is just an outrageous, misinformed notion. In fact, what's happening is that year after year, ethanol production is getting more and more efficient. When you go from coal to natural gas to waste dump methane in your heating, and when you develop new processes and work the efficiency and production efficiency to make sure you're not putting extra energy into it and so forth, as you fine-tune this process, you take energy out of it and you make the production of ethanol even more efficient. So there's two major arguments out there that we need you to be experts in. And we need you on the front lines winning this fight. It's food versus fuel. Ain't no such thing. There's plenty of everything we need to have all the fuel we want and all the food we want. And the carbon intensity of ethanol. It's less than half the carbon intensity of gasoline, and there's really no value in this indirect land usage model. It is an academic, theoretical construct that doesn't have a basis in reality. And we're in that fight today, and we need your support in it. You got to talk it up in the local communities. You got to explain to people what's at stake. You've got to talk up those two issues. You've got to tie it to America's national security, because this is about America's national security. Across the Midwest and where I live, every few weeks, there's another young man or woman who comes back, and there's a funeral. And there's other people you don't see. And they're coming back maimed and injured. And these families, they're pretty stoic. They're not out there complaining in public, and they're proud of their sacrifice and proud of what they've done for standing up for America. But the point is, we don't have to do it. That's our choice. This is about national security, and we can move America toward energy independence. We've got to talk up the productivity of American agriculture. We've got to talk up the scale of our industry. When I go around America and I talk to people about how big ethanol is, $66 billion, 500,000 people, they had no idea. They thought it was a couple of guys, you know, with a kettle in the bathroom. They didn't know what it was. They know about it every 4 years. Some presidential candidates go to Iowa and say, I'm a big believer in ethanol. I take the ethanol pledge. And they make a joke out of it. This is no joke. This is big business. It's America's business. And it's serious national security business. But you all are at a crucial point. As the owners of plants and as innovators in this area, you're at a crucial point in the cycle of development. We're in what in the military we'd call an operational pause. The country's sort of taking a deep breath and asking itself, okay, where are we going? Where are we going? Is it going to be, okay, we got to start on ethanol, but no, that was a mistake, or is it, by golly, this is a great American success story. And it's up to each and every one of us to help the country make the right decision. You know how to do it. You know how to reach out to your congressional representatives, to your legislators, to your local leaders, to the communities, to the Rotaries, the Lions Clubs, all the service clubs. You know how to reach people in the environmental groups. You know how to reach the academic institutions. You're connected to everywhere. They just don't understand it. We've been so busy working to improve our own productivity, we haven't reached out to the larger community, and now we got to do it. This is about America's future. It's about whether we're going to take the challenge, seize the opportunity, and build the kind of energy independence that will keep America strong and safe for the next 100 years. Or not. When I got out of the military, I was looking through some old papers, and I found a poem that I had been required to memorize in eighth grade English, and probably a lot of you memorize the same poem, and it's by a guy named Carl Sandburg. It's about the city of, it's titled Chicago. And like a lot of things you do in school, you do things you don't really realize what it's about. So I reread it. I realized that this was more than about a city. Now, I want to read you some, in conclusion, just a few lines from this poem, because I think you'll see the drift. This is Carl Sandburg's view of Chicago and America in 1912, almost 100 years ago. And here's the way he describes us. Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. Come and show me another city, he writes, with lifted head singing, so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who's never lost a battle. That was a pretty good vision of 20th century America. The country's moved on. But in the American heartland, there's a lot of us who believe in this country. And we're in an industry that can take this country forward in the 21st century. But to do it, we're going to have to hold our head up. We're going to have to be proud. It's not that we never lost a fight, but we're in a fight right now. And we're going to be stormy, husky, and brawling, and we're going to take that fight to the public, and we're going to show them how good this industry is, how good you are, and how important we are to the future of the United States of America. That's the mission. That's where we're going. And we need you. Thank you.